The UK Psych Health and Safety and ISO 45003 podcast. The goal of the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast is to be your source of information on psychological injury prevention, health promotion, and best practice. In doing this, we aim to rapidly advance the global practice of psychological health and safety in workplaces and adoption of best practices from the ISO 45003 standard. We will be looking at fully integrated approaches to managing psych health and safety and well-being strategy in the workplace that meet the needs of everyone in the organisation. Your regular host will be Peter Kelly, Senior Psychologist with the UK Health and Safety Executive, and Sheila Lord of BMR Health and Wellbeing. Every week, we will have a guest episode from the fields of health and safety, human resources, psychology, and academia who are leading the way in their corner of the globe.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast. I am joined today by David Liddell, who is the CEO of the TCM Group. Now, David's a thought leader in the areas of organisational dynamics, conflict resolution and transformational culture. And he's also authored two highly acclaimed books called Managing Conflict and Transformational Culture. And in addition to that already impressive introduction, David was also ranked in the top 20 HR Most Influential Thinkers for 2021 by HR Magazine. So David, quite an impressive resume. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and you've definitely given my ego a little bit of a boost there. Thank you so much for that amazing introduction.
You're most welcome, you're most welcome. So in today's podcast, we're going to be talking about organisational cultures and what a good organisational culture should look like and how we go about creating these better cultures. So David, it'd be really interesting for our listeners if you can give us a little bit of an update on your career so far in this space.
Thanks, Sheila. It's great to be here. So my career today is been very much focused around the core element of justice and helping to resolve problems. I began working in the community, in schools, in prisons, and more recently in workplaces, resolving problems, conflicts, challenges, issues within the workplace using a form of justice, which is about collaboration, compassion, dialogue and an open, honest and frank exchange between the participants. It's called restorative justice. And what I do as a restorative justice practitioner is bring people together to resolve often intransigent issues where the formal, procedural and adversarial justice systems have failed. So my background, I began with a degree in race and community relations back in the late 80s, and I ran a charity specialising in restorative justice and mediation in the wonderful city of Leicester in the East Midlands. And I ran the charity through pretty much the 1990s. I completed an MBA in the late 90s, early noughties. And actually was really exciting in the MBA. I got an opportunity to examine the use of restorative justice in two large London boroughs. And it really opened up my eyes to the failed and broken systems of justice in our organisations. And we'll come to those today, but systems which were adversarial, draconian, punitive, and often destroyed relationships and destroyed people rather than actually focusing on helping to bring out their inner brilliance. And I became a passionate advocate of people-centered, purpose-driven, fair and just systems resolving issues. And my entire career is built from that. And I guess when I began, people rolled their eyes, Sheila. They were like, you know, who's this old hippie? Perhaps I wasn't so old at the time. You know, coming in, people didn't take this stuff seriously. They felt the only way to get a good outcome to a problem was to apply a formal procedure and it will result in an outcome which is good for all. And it never worked. It's dragging people through a hedge backwards. As I said, it destroyed relationships, but actually and paradoxically, it was the least effective way to getting a resolution. So I've been really inspired by organisations who are making the shift towards a new system of justice, a more radical form of justice, if you're all more people-centred form of justice. So that's really, in my career in a nutshell, could be defined as a mission to change the way we think about justice in our organisations.
Fantastic. So let's pick up on that then, David. Let's talk about organisational cultures. So what does a good organisational culture look like in today's environment?
I'm glad you've asked me that question. It's such an important question because there's so many words that describe a bad culture: toxic, blame, difficult, challenging. There's so many words. But actually, when you start to think about what does good culture look like, and when I was doing research for my book, it was actually really hard to identify and understand what good culture looked like. It was almost like there was a fear of actually setting out what good looks like. And what I tried to do was define a good culture, what a good culture might look like, because of course, every organization is different. Every culture is going to be different. But I start off by thinking about good culture as being purpose-driven, a clear purpose that unifies all the stakeholders, excuse the jargon, but our HR professionals, our managers, our leaders, our employees, our unions, are all falling within and falling behind a sense of common purpose. We're all supporting and working towards achieving a sense of common purpose. Something which is intrinsically values-based, where my beliefs and values align to the organization's values, but those values within the organization act as a golden thread upon which we layer all of the other aspects of our organization. No doubt today, one of the areas we'll talk about is HR processes and how they can become more values-based. And the other aspects, so purpose-driven, values-based, and the final point is about person-centered. Putting people at the heart of our organisations, putting the person, the human being, at the centre of our organisations and building out from that. Human beings are not human resources. They're people who bring fantastic skills and brilliance into our organisations. And a good culture unlocks that inner brilliance of those people within our workforce. Our managers and leaders are equipped and skilled to create inclusive, safe, healthy workplaces that unlocks that brilliance. And you know something, Sheila, this might sound for some people as all, this is all very nice, this is all rose-tinted glasses, this is all very idealistic. The evidence is stacking up that person-centered, values-based, people's purpose-driven, values-based, and people-centered organizations deliver higher performance, higher productivity, and are more effective and more sustainable. And that is at the heart, I think, of what a good organizational culture looks like.
Fantastic. And just picking up on what you were saying there, David, about, you know, having a business where people's values align to the organization's values. I was reading a report this morning about the future of work 2022. And for a survey result that was carried out as part of the research for that report showed that 71% of professionals surveyed would take a lesser salary to work for an organization whose values aligned with theirs, which is a huge number, isn't it?
Massive number, but it doesn't surprise me. You know, we're not robots. You know, we're not automating processes. Or we are people, and our values and our beliefs and our whole selves are really important to us. And of course, for organisations, we've said to our people, bring your whole self to work. And of course, our whole selves are concerned about social justice. We're concerned about the environment. We're concerned about the economy. We're concerned about poverty. We're challenging leadership. We're challenging the norms and the status quo in our society. Bringing your whole self to work. People are bringing their whole selves into the workplace. And what they're finding is rigid, bureaucratic, complex systems and processes and managers and leaders who are oftentimes not skilled or confident or competent to have the conversations to understand what are driving people's values and beliefs are the organisations who are really struggling. But those organisations who recognise this and see it as important and are actually building it into their infrastructure, into their culture, they're the ones where the top talent will go, the top investors will go, and the top customers will go. And so surely it's not just about aligning the values within the organisation, it's recognising that is at the heart of a successful business for the future.
Fantastic. So With culture, a lot of this is definitely, you know, kind of driven from the leadership teams and it cascades down generally in terms of culture. So if we've got organisations that are not human-centred, they're not taking this human approach and that the environment's toxic or whatever, or, you know, if there's a blame culture, whatever the negative aspect of that potentially is, how do we then go about transforming these toxic cultures if it's starting at the top?
I'm going to come back on that one a bit. I see a lot of boss bashing in our organisations and a lot of blame and fingers. It's very convenient to point a finger at blame someone. We want to blame someone for the failure. It's the leader's fault. I suppose it's intrinsically true, you know, how we lead and the role that the leaders play in our organisations. But I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. And I think the leader plays an absolutely critical and vital role in helping to shape and structure the organisational culture. And when it goes wrong, clearly there's responsibility. But when I go into organisations, I'm much more curious to understand what are the norms that exist within the organisation in terms of people being able to speak up and listening. And at a local level, that's about managers having the skills to listen, to actively listen, to act with compassion, and to hear what their employees are saying and to value that, helping employees to disagree well. One of the cultural norms I see when I'm working with toxic cultures as a mediator, a facilitator, or as, when I'm doing cultural change work, is that we've lost the art of disagreeing well. Disagreements very quickly become entrenched and polarized and dogmatic, and managers are left unable to handle that. So let's start by equipping our managers to have the skills at a local level, at climate, to be able to create a climate of psychological safety, of openness, and recognizing that managing these issues isn't just a good, morally, ethically sound thing to do. Actually, it's the key to unlocking creativity and innovation. So the role of managers is vital. We need to invest in our managers, and sending them on a difficult conversations course or a grievance management course in 2006 does not cut the mustard on how to give them the skills to be able to resolve complex issues in 2022. And the second one is our HR processes. The grievance disciplinary and performance procedures are dangerous. They are a public health emergency. They're causing alarm and distress. They're damaging relationships. They are toxic and poisonous. They're corrosive, they're insidious and adversarial, yet we wheel them out as if they do no harm, as if they're going to resolve issues. They don't. They destroy people's lives. They destroy relationships. So using our formal processes actually makes matters much worse. And the smart organisations and modern organisations are saying, no, let's focus on resolution and introduce a resolution framework to be able to resolve these issues, not relied on these tired and weary and damaging HR processes. Discipline, performance and grievance procedures should be banned with immediate effect because of the they are so utterly dangerous. And the third one is the role of our leaders in our organisations, role modelling the right behaviours, being open to change, driving the values within the organisation, owning those values and aligning their own behaviours to those values. So it's not perceived as one rule for them and another rule for us. So there's a real alignment between the leadership, the values, the behaviours and the needs of the workforce within the organisation. And there are other people playing a key role in this, of course, the trade unions, employee groups, workplace councils and others all play a critical role within this ecosystem to be able to create a positive workplace culture. So it's too easy to say it's leadership, but clearly leaders play a critical role.
David.
Hi, Peter.
Couldn't agree with you more as a trade union rep.
Thank you.
obviously, you know, I'm at the other side, you know, supporting people through these grievance processes. So they are at times very traumatic for people to engage in, and they don't really bring resolution unless you've got a really good trade union rep.
It's not a resolution, it's Pyrrhic. And yeah. It's a tick for the trade union rep, but it's not a tick for the employee. I don't think they resolve the underlying issues which gave rise to the problem. They simply were an opportunity often on procedural failings of the organisation to catch the organisation up for not following its timescales effectively. So they never work, they never have worked, and they never will work.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the real world experience for people in it is it's extremely difficult. There's you have to offer high levels of emotional support to people as they're going through it. And, you know, so by default, I would prefer always to seek to find resolution before we've got to there by having conversations or engaging, you know, finding a way through. But sometimes that doesn't happen. I wonder what your thoughts are, however. Moving it on slightly, obviously, the last 2 years have been quite a marked change in work and what we've seen, you know, obviously is workplace cultures have had to change or shaped differently by the pandemic. As we've learned to sort of navigate our new ways of learning. So how's that settled into your area? Because obviously there's a new form of potentially of of difficult relationships building up over the internet, over the Zoom meetings, over team meetings, over having messenger services, which constantly you have to be on, you have to be available, you have to be alert. And I know from conversations with some people that they find that almost like the dystopian 1984 Big Brother being watched all the time. So do you care to comment?
Yeah, I think, and the world of work is changing. I think this, I think this presents a once in a lifetime opportunity for us to think and rethink what it means to be at work and in work and in the workplace. And I think the conversation that we've had so far in terms of that more values-based, person-centered, purpose-driven kind of environment, I think is key there. I think rethinking, there's an opportunity to rethink certain key roles within our organisations. The role of managers, as I've mentioned earlier, that focus on a more compassionate, collaborative, supportive role of management, rather than the one you've described there of using these systems to monitor and scrutinize people. We can't be our most brilliant best when we're being watched and scrutinized and evaluated through a system. So how can we create an environment where people can work at home or work in the office or work where they need to do the best job they can and be the most brilliant version of themselves? And it requires a very different conversation, a more radical conversation from a management leader based on listening and hearing and understanding rather than judging, evaluating and blaming. I think there's also a real zeitgeist moment here for the HR function. I think that going back to the conversation about HR processes, people are really challenging what it means to be in HR. And I think people are starting to ask, what is the purpose of HR? Is HR the guardian and custodian of formal policies and processes? Or are they the driver of engagement and creating a healthy, harmonious, happy, high-performing workplace? And this is a real opportunity for the HR function to grab the concept of culture and good culture and to own the agenda of good culture and to transform from an HR function driven by transactional processes to a transformational model of HR driven by a focus on people and culture. So I see the shifts in the tectonic plates of the workplace driven by geopolitical changes through Brexit, of course, and also through the pandemic as one of the greatest opportunities we have in our society to rethink the world of work.
Do we move back to a trust-based relationship with our employees?
A revision of the social contract, Peter. And I think, thinking about the role of our trade unions, thinking about the role of leaders, managers and HR and the employer and the workforce, it is a rethink of the social contract and moving from confrontation to collaboration. Now, I've worked with Royal Mail, I've worked with major banks, I've implemented significant changes in the social contract through partnership frameworks, mediated outcomes and facilitation. And those organisations where they build in trust, it's about trust, it's about respect and it's about open communication, that tripartite focus of that contract, the social contract and the psychological contract. The organisations that are getting that right are the organisations that will thrive. The organisations that get that wrong will the organisations who will constantly be walking through a jungle of challenge and discord and disharmony.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? Social contract and the psychological contract, both areas of research that were established 25 years ago, 30 years, well, probably social constructs even longer than that.
Yes, yeah.
And yet they're still almost coming to the forefront. And I wonder if that's because we've been on this sort of journey of exploring what it means to work. And we've gone through different types of work. We've gone from a traditionally physical-based industries in the 60s and 70s, moving into IT or more office space in the late 70s, 80s, into the 90s, and the earliest. What's after the 90s? Okay, I always get myself confused.
Service economy.
Eh?
The gig economy. The noughties.
The noughties and the gig
economy. That's right.
But work has, the nature of work has changed. And I remember I was challenged once at a conference about, is stress a recent phenomena? I said, well, I think priests in the Reformation would have been pretty stressed out. And if we'd seen that canary die in the die on his perch down the mine, you'd be pretty stretched out. I think what's changed, and that's just got worse, is how we interact with the systems around us. So, you know, I remember getting a 286 computer. I thought it was amazing, 286K. And yet now I have a phone that has the ability to hold 10,000 plus files, all at the touch of a fingertip. And yet what we haven't done, and you'll notice this in some of the conflicts we see in work, is things like emails. We don't, you know, things like email protocol. You know, what kind of email should you send? When do you send them? How do you send them? What should you be saying it? What shouldn't you be saying it? And so I'm wondering, you know, obviously, as we discussed, you know, culturally, many things have changed during 2020, in the last 2 years, and going forward into 2022, many things will change. What are the lessons, though, for HR from the pandemic? What are the absolute take-home things that HR should be thinking about, rather than going back to the default of treating the individual? Or do you think they should just be treating the individual? If you do, we need to have a conversation.
HR needs to unshackle itself as being perceived as the long arm of management in the workplace. I think the term business partner should be removed from the HR lexicon with immediate effect. It's perceived by the employees being immediately that HR is on the arm of the business, and the business is defined as the leadership and management, ergo HR is on the side of the management. Come on, HR, people are the business. So become people and culture function, people and culture partners, and become a fully independent function within the workplace. Not there to take the side of management, not there to be seen to be supporting bad management practices, and certainly not there to be seen as a system which acts to reduce the risk of an employment and an adverse tribunal outcome. So releasing itself from that, using evidence and data. I mean, I go into boardrooms, Peter, and I say to them, we talk about conflict, about the impact of conflict within the workplace, from the health issues around suicide, around harm to others, psychological and physical health, to the cost of the organisation, reputational harm and so on. And everyone in the boardroom is nodding that this is a real problem and it's backed up by evidence. Yeah, I say to those same leaders, well, show me your conflict resolution strategy. Show me the strategy that manages this. And I've seen better strategies for ordering paperclips than I have for dealing with these issues in the workplace. So we need HR to drive a culture work to support our leaders and others to treat culture and conflict as strategic priorities. And then HR function, or the people and culture function, then devising systems and processes which actually help to deliver the purpose, the values, and a person-centered organization. So as I said already, you know, scrapping those discipline, grievance, and performance procedures, which never work, they never have worked, and they never will work. Removing them and replacing them with an overarching resolution framework, creating a culture hub or a transformational culture hub, bringing together the union partners, the leaders and managers and other key stakeholders to work collaboratively. So working in a proactive and predictive way rather than in a reactive way, which is often what happens when we are dealing with problems in the workplace. So creating a proactive and predictive culture and using evidence, because there's bags of evidence in our organisations and bags of data that can help the people and culture function to create its people and culture strategy, which is aligned to the purpose, the values, and the people of the organisation. So using that data effectively to drive strategic level decision making and challenging some of the norms and the status quo. So those are just some of the challenges for HR. But if HR, I think, continues to rely on these transactional systems to resolve problems, they're going to be running into a whole lot of trouble because they're being rejected wholesale now by work.
Transformational leadership, transformational management, or transformational culture, I think is a consequence. Was always there, but actually it's come to the forefront. You know, transactional leaders during this pandemic of transactional systems have failed because they weren't really embedded in the process of that. Actually, that you could take somebody along. We've all, as you know, worked for people and seen examples of transformational leadership. And I think certainly from the pandemic perspective, it's that change. It, you know, for me, I've been talking a lot about putting people at the center of your decisions and people in your organization. I know it sounds very woolly, but you know, I'm sat in my office in my end of terrace house on my own doing these webinars. And that's a very different workplace than me going into work and spending time with colleagues, etc. So I agree entirely with what you're saying, which is actually change the narrative around culture and around how we support people. One of the things we do ask about in these talks and regularly is your thoughts on the new ISO standard 45003, and obviously you'll be aware of other standards 45001. And then there are new standards coming out from the pandemic. But you know, what are your thoughts on 45003? Where do you see it as a useful addition? Do you see it as something that could be helpful or not?
I mean, anything that helps to shift the narrative and shift the dial on a greater focus on health and safety in the workplace has to be a good thing. I'm not an expert on them, Peter. I wouldn't claim to be, but I did have a little look this morning before our podcast just to remind me. And I was looking through them to try and find some reference to my particular favourite topics of culture and in particular conflict, and conflict as a antecedent to high levels of stress and distress and damaged relationships. And I can see you've got them there. And if you can find a reference, I'd love to know, but I couldn't find a reference, but I only did a quick skim. And it seems to me that conflict, and you know, unless there's a big chapter in there and you're going to point it out to me and I'll stop speaking. But until that happens, it feels to me that every time I see anything around safety in the workplace, and obviously there's a much greater focus now on psychological safety and the wonderful work of Amy Edmondson to raise the profile of that. However, conflict, disagreement and tension in the workplace is an antecedent to stress, distress, anxiety and everything that goes with it seems to me to be perpetually ignored and understated when we're tackling these issues. Yet when I go into research and I do research and also reading other evidence, conflict between colleagues or with managers or more widely in the workplace is a major contributory factor to ill health, harm and distress. So I see you've just done a quick skim there, Peter. Am I completely missed it there? And there's a great big chunk on there about managing.
Well, no, there are chunks. 6.1.2.1.2, which aspects of how work is organized. Under social factors, it talks about interpersonal relationships and organizational workplace culture. But it would be very difficult to find under a skim. But there is definitely there's reference to it in there, and that, but then also a recommendation of kind of things you might want to do, which is interesting really, because restorative justice was on the table when we were talking about the development of the standard. As colleagues in other countries are much more advanced in this area than we are, and saying, you know, we have to have this in, we have to, you know, we have to sort of look at opportunities, you know, to manage this, and bring it into the standard. And bullying is also covered as well. So for example, under organizational culture, work group culture, poor communication, low level support for problem solving, personal development, lack of definition on or agreement on organizational objectives, inconsistent or untimely application of policies and procedures, unfair decision making and stuff. And then it sort of goes into a can-do act sort of process. But yeah, it's not a large chunk of it.
Yeah, so forgive me. I think it's good to see that in there, because I mean it's kind of, you know, I'm not active in that space, but I have been aware of, you know, the HSE standards, stress standards, and so on and so forth, and various other pieces of work in this area. And it's really good to hear some of those messages that are coming through in the ISO 45003. I think sending out a message around the relationships between individuals, the processes and how they're being applied, management systems and HR processes, I think are absolutely key. So I'm really pleased to hear that. And
it was a bit of a fight to get these things in, but they're in there. So
that's brilliant.
Yeah. But, so we've got like internal issues, how organization is governed, managed, you know, accepted responsibilities. But I would rather see, you know, where I come from in, you know, the psychological contract is at the heart of what I'm looking at. You know, how do we encourage people to go to work and stay healthy? Well, part of that is making them feel that they're cared for and that they're looked after, and that they get the right recompense for the amount of effort that they put in. And when that there is a disjoint, then we're into the realms of, you know, discord, which is because actually your values don't line up. It's a restorative justice, isn't it? I just love the fact that all the old stuff is still here, and we're still having this. We for probably now are having sensible conversations about this. Whereas I think in the past, we've just people gone, oh, I don't want to, not really. It's a bit wishy-washy. I'm not really interested in that. Even, you know, and I think that's a failing of organisations to adapt, to realise that they have to do. As you said, successful organisations have processes in place to find a way through conflict and find resolution in a way that is beneficial to both of them, don't they?
That's why I wrote my two books, Managing Conflict and Transformational Culture. And I think one of the reasons I think it's been around, certainly on in sort of these justice models, have been on the periphery for a while, is I think a lack of clear evidence and data to support their implementation, not just on a moral and ethical perspective, but also on a clear business perspective. And certainly the challenges I wanted to take on, Peter, and demonstrate to organizations, is this isn't just the right thing to do because it's the right thing to do, which is a good reason if ever there was one, but it's also good for your business. And actually, as I said to Shia earlier, it will be, I think, drawing in the smart investment, the top talent and the top customers now are discerning and expect more. And I think, yeah, the great resignation that we're reading about at the moment demonstrates that people are willing to make a real difference in their lives if they don't feel they're getting their needs fulfilled. So I think ultimately it's about having really good quality conversations with people about what is it that you need and how can we work together to meet those needs in a supportive, systematic way. And that's, I think, again, I go back to my point, I think it's a really great opportunity to start to do these things differently.
So David, just picking up on that, you know, we're in 2022 now. We're kind of moving into, you know, this more permanent way of hybrid working.
Yes.
Again, that in itself, you know, the pandemic's identified that we need to take this more human-centered approach. We need to do organizational culture shifts and changes. But now we're having to do that in a way that's semi-remote. So that in itself is going to present a huge amount of challenge for HR professionals, for leadership, for people managers. How do we learn to navigate that, and how can organizations, the different structures within organizations, the HR people, the leadership teams, the management teams, how do they start to navigate managing culture, improving culture, and creating this new work environment where people still feel included, collaborated with, communicated with, and part of a business when a lot of that's going to be remote?
I mean, I keep hearing about people talking about hybrid as if it's something that we need to work around or work with. Hybrid is let's have our cake and eat it. You know, hybrid's the most fantastic thing. I think it's the best opportunity. It could be one of the best things that's ever happened to the world of work. I can talk about my own organisation. So very simply, I mean, we have about a dozen people in our head office in London and 60 freelance consultants. So on our Monday, we're all in the office, everyone's in. And then one day a week, barring Friday when the office is closed and no one's in on a Friday, everyone's on rota. Maybe they do one or two people in the office. So everyone is in on a Monday. We get that fellowship, that opportunity to meet, that community within the office. we then everyone's in one additional day, and then everyone works from home on a Friday. So you can get through your to-do list, you can get the work done, you can do the calls that you need to do, you can do whatever it is that you're needing to do, and they get that quiet time. And everyone I talk to, whether it's in my own organization or other organizations, is saying this is one of the best ways of working. I think we can overthink this and we can overplay it and overcomplicate it. And perhaps we want to create processes and policies and procedures around that. And that's what's driving this. But actually, hybrid working is a remarkably amazing way of working. And I think if it works for the individuals and it works for the organizations, is to me, it's certainly in the 30 years that I've been a leader of an organization, this model of working is the best model I've ever seen, and the most productive, the most harmonious, the one that has the biggest sense of everyone's in it and supporting each other. I see very little downsides. So let's not wrap it up in complexity. Let's not try and dot every I and cross every T and have every eventuality. We need to trust people, let people, you know, get on with the jobs and trust them that they're going to do a good job and allow them to do that. But to me, let's make hybrid the new normal, because to me, I'm seeing very few downsides. But let's not overthink it, and let's not try and overcomplicate it. There's a tendency to do that, and it might spoil something which to me looks really quite special.
I think picking up on one of the words that you used there, and I think it's a key word when it comes to this hybrid model and anything related to culture, is trust. Because if, you know, I speak to people that work in organisations that have performed well through the pandemic with people working remotely. Yet their employers, now that, life is returning more to normal, are insisting that the way of work returns to 5 days in the office, everybody working in, because they want people there. And it's basically boiling down to this lack of trust, which is causing disharmony now within the workplace. So trust is a massive factor, isn't it?
It's the central factor. And I think, you know, why would you do that? Why would you do that? I mean, why would you not have a good quality conversation with your workforce to find out what's worked for them in the 2 years of the pandemic, the challenges that they faced? Because, of course, we've had to overcome enormous obstacles, health obstacles, just getting ourselves set. And there's been so many factors that people have overcome, the resilience that they've shown, the loyalty that they've shown, the trust that they've had, and that we've trusted them. Why would we just, like a rubber band, pull back and snap back to the old where it's worked? And I think, again, from a cultural perspective, it doesn't align to those transformational principles that I was describing earlier. And it's those kind of cultures where I think that real change can happen. And I think those are real opportunities to happen. And I think if the changes won't happen, those organizations will either slowly and inexorably fail, or they will go out in a blaze of social media storm when everyone just gets fed up, they turn into social media. I think those organizations who are doing that and are not taking advantage or optimizing the advantages that have come through the pandemic will be ones that I might be wrong, Sheila, but I would predict that those are the organizations that are going to really struggle and will have, you know, they'll lose the talent they want to keep, and they'll keep the talent, the people they want to lose, and slowly they'll lose competitive advantage, they'll lose the talent advantage, they'll lose the cultural advantage. So if one of those leaders of those organizations is listening to this, I'd say, you know, go and listen to your people. They've got some great stories to tell, and they'll help you shape a very modern, a very productive, and a very effective world of work. Go and give them a jolly good listening to.
That's fantastic. Fantastic advice, David. And to be honest, that would be normally our closing question, but I think you've answered it before we've even asked the question, which is what would be your advice to business leaders? And I think what you've just said there has absolutely covered that. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you today, and I'm sure Peter and I could talk to you, could do a 24-hour podcast on this subject. But just before we wrap up, again, bringing it back to the human element, tell us something about David. You know, what is David's guilty pleasure that most people would never, ever guess about you?
Wow, okay. There's not many, I suppose, but, you know, it has just been Christmas. So it's one of my guilty pleasures is I've got a real sweet tooth. And obviously at Christmas time, there's a lot of chocolate doing the rounds. And for some reason this year, there wasn't much chocolate found its way in my direction. I don't know why, but there's lots. I've got three children and they seem to get lots of chocolate. So one of my guilty pleasures was we were watching various TV programs. In fact, I was sat watching Band of Brothers, actually really enjoyed it with my oldest son through Christmas. But I'd nip upstairs to the kids' bedrooms and go and nick a little chocolate bar or two to feed my sweet tooth. So don't tell them I said that, because I think they're still wondering. I was probably blaming the naughty elves, but my guilty pleasure was going and nicking their chocolate bars over the Christmas holiday.
Brilliant. Excellent. Well, thank you for your time today, David. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you, and we really appreciate you coming on the show.
Sheila, Peter, thank you so much
thank for having you.
Me. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, thank you very much for inviting me to be part of it.
You've been listening to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention and the new ISO 45003 standard, follow subscribe to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.ukpsychhealthandsafety.com.